It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover in a short 29 minutes.
We'll do it.
All right.
Let's go.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, did we want to mention the email?
Oh, we do? I always forget that I haven't been properly trained. We will try and take, near the end of the show, your questions via email or phone, but we don't answer your phone ones till next week since we have no one live here to do that for us. Email is dj@kexp.org. So if you have a question for Java or Maria, you can send it to us there, and we'll do our best to get to that before the end of the half hour. Starting out with the local coverage, Seattle school districts trying to come up with solutions for saving money, and the latest one is not got a lot of happy people.
No. In fact, the Seattle School District was forced to admit this week that the closure plan, the plan that was submitted by Raj Manhas to the board, that would have
wildly unpopular.
Yeah, that's wildly unpopular. It would have closed 10 schools in the district. Is not actually going to save the district money overall. In fact, there's some debate about it. It turns out that the plan, while it will close some schools and save some money for the operating budget, is going to cost the capital budget, the budget that's used for building new buildings and renovations, et cetera, is going to cost that budget more money. And so it actually is not going to be an overall money saver.
And in fact, it's getting a lot of flack from people because it's targeting schools that actually seem to be having the model of what everybody's been calling for, which is smaller schools with, you know, smaller class size.
Exactly. They targeted schools that were the smallest. A lot of them are alternative schools or Montessori schools. A lot of them have very, very heavy parent involvement. North Beach in particular has very high test scores. So there's a lot of mobilization going on to try and save all of these schools. And these revelations came in the middle of that this week. And so probably that closure plan is in trouble, I would think.
Although personally, I'm thinking the school district is probably, you know, it's hard sometimes to tell what's going through people's minds when they propose these things. But if I were in charge of the school district and I proposed something like that, I would be thinking, but down the line we can sell the buildings and the land, and that'll make up for the cost to the capital budget. So not only are they going to try to close these schools, but they're also probably going to try to get rid of some of this property by selling it, which means more development and uncontrolled development in these neighborhoods with these larger tracts of land and these large, beautiful, old, historic buildings.
Mm. Yeah, that was a letter in the editor to the editor today, and one of the papers had said one of the schools proposed for closure over near Green Lake was just on prime real estate that people are salivating.
Yeah,
over.
So you can bet they're probably figuring that it'll balance out or maybe make some money for the capital budget if they sell these properties. But then you have to turn around and ask yourself, if I live in that neighborhood, do I want to see that that building being torn down, that school being closed, which does in fact increase the value of your own property if you live near a school, as anybody will tell you. But do you want to see that building torn down and turned into condominiums or something else?
Yeah, giant Walmart.
Yeah.
All right. Moving along, the city of Seattle is finally coming out with plans for more electricity down in South Lake Union. Got to power up that biotech.
Yeah, in order to support the large number of jobs and the large amount of new supposedly, I'm guessing, condominium housing that's going to go in to serve the influx of workers in South Lake Union, the Seattle City Light has said that they're going to have to build a new substation in South Lake Union to the tune of about $100 million. That's taxpayer money that's going to go into that. That's not money from Vulcan, which is the company owned by Paul Allen. And Paul Allen's company owns a large amount of property in the South Lake Union area. They've been the major mover behind development of the South Lake Union area.
And
they're going to be the main recipient of this, of having a new substation built in order to upgrade facilities and get biotech labs in, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so once again, what we're seeing basically is a mandate for a private company, to benefit a private company in South Lake Union, where taxpayers are going to have to fund the bill, and they're going to have to fund it without ever being consulted by it. You know, it's not like any of this has ever been put up for a vote. It's not like, you know, it's basically Mayor Nichols steamrolling the city council and having his way, and Vulcan having their way. And
Yeah, and of course, Mayor Nichols would say, well, we get all those extra jobs and we get this new business and they pay taxes into the Treasury. However, is that amount going to offset the $100 million spent on a new substation, the money spent on a new streetcar for the area, and the money spent to upgrade Mercer Street and make all these other street improvements that are specified in this overall plan to develop South Lake Union? I think the answer to that is probably no.
Well, I think this whole thing, obviously, as we're saying, deserves more scrutiny. To his credit, John Fox had actually, through FOIA requests, had dug up a lot of the details on this months back, and I had been over at his office reading some of those. And if my recollection is correct, some of the proposals they were planning for this power station were putting it potentially on land that Paul Allen owned, and then the city buying it back, eventually Paul Allen throwing in money at first and the city buying this facility back, or it was the reverse of that. But it was clearly this.
So it's a public-private partnership.
Public-private partnership was what was on the table. And
Well, let's for a minute remind folks of one of the more recent public-private partnerships, the sale of a warehouse by the Port of Seattle for much, much less than its market value, and then having to buy it back for a much higher price later on. I think that's pretty emblematic of what often happens in these deals, where the mayor cuts a deal with a business friend, and the business friend gets the better half of the deal.
Well, and to bring up one more example of a public-private partnership that directly involved Paul Allen again, the Seahawks Stadium, mm-hmm. where the deal was, is that he would have to open his books to the team.
Yeah.
Would have to open their books.
And he's been refusing to.
And he's refused to. And the state's stance on this, when approached by, well, then why don't you take him to court, was, we don't have the money to take him on someone of that stature in court, so we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And that's just amazing.
So obviously, Allen is learning something from these public-private partnerships, namely that they're a major benefit to him, and that the city isn't going to pursue him. The city and the state aren't going to pursue him.
I mean, look how he became a billionaire in the first place. I mean, Microsoft was underwritten to a great degree also in its development.
All right. Moving along. The University of Washington, there was several articles yesterday, and actually, to their credit, Tacoma News Tribune has been following this issue for the entire week about the UW violating human research rules. And
okay, we're all looking at each other. Who wants to go first?
Who's going to jump?
Yeah, I think that when I heard about this, I thought I was pretty appalled. I mean, that's the one thing that really needs a lot of oversight, is when a university undertakes human trials when they do human research, and it's pretty clear that nobody's been keeping an eye on the UW, and in particular nobody in the UW has been keeping an eye on the procedures involved here. And I think that's just scandalous.
Or the feds. The feds haven't been keeping an eye on it either. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they didn't even know about it in this case.
Yeah, and the UW is the one university in the nation that gets the most federal dollars. They really go out there and
research dollars.
They really go out there and really look for the money. And when the money comes in, there appears to be few strings attached.
So again, we're hearing about this concept of oversight. Well, also,
almost makes you wonder what would happen with a bio lab, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for that segue. Connected to that, also this week, the media picked up on an incident that had happened last year at a BSL-3 lab in downtown Seattle, a company called IDRI, which had...
Yeah, you thought there were no major biotech research labs in the most heavily populated, or at least the most heavily populated during a large portion of the day, part of the city. But in fact, there are. They're all over the city. And in this case, three lab workers at this BSL Level 3 lab contracted tuberculosis after working with the germ in the lab. And how long were they infected with the disease and they were out walking around with it?
Well, that's what we're still not sure on, because mm-hmm. they get tested once a month, so potentially it could have been like for several weeks they could have been walking amongst us.
Wow. Yeah.
Fortunately, TB is not heavily communicable like some of the diseases that are researched in BSL Level 3 and Level 4 labs.
And it's treatable also.
Mm-hmm. And it's treatable. It's curable. And I believe, isn't this right, Mike, that the only way that this information was not released to the public, and the only way that we know about it is because the workers filed workers' comp or L&I claim.
Yeah, that is correct. Mm-hmm. So, and that again came out in one of the articles that when the state was asked about, you know, why this company didn't report the accident, the state had pointed out, well, there's no requirements for it since they're just a research lab.
which means pretty clearly that we need some kind of some better oversight of research labs. That's a problem nationwide. It's not just a problem here in the state of Washington or the city of Seattle. It's all over the country. There isn't much oversight of these labs, not by any specific federal agency or by any agency that gives them money. And that's a problem.
Mm. So again, yeah, when proponents for these labs are coming forward and saying, well, we know of no exposures that, you know, mm-hmm. affected members of the public, it's like, well, perhaps one of the reasons for that is that there's no mechanisms for people reporting these.
Yeah, there's no requirement that accidents be reported, and so we just don't know. Yeah, that's not a good excuse. That's not a good reason to support the construction of a BSL-3 or a BSL-4 lab in your neighborhood.
Yeah, and at the same time, the competition for research grants for these facilities is getting more and more competitive, and so you have pressure on the labs to not report this kind of stuff because, you know, they have to in their proposals and their grants put forward the quality of the work that they've already done. You don't want to have to say we've had these accidents, we've had these exposures to workers, we've had these problems with control.
That's right.
So it just doesn't get put out there.
Yeah, I think the biggest objection I have to the lab is the fact that, again, it's a public-private partnership deal where the state will kick in money to build this lab for the university, but the university won't be able to fill it. A large portion of the lab space is going to be rented back out to private companies who I'm sure will get a really, really good deal for the use of public space. Another big problem with it, too, is that, oh God, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, and you're talking specifically of the proposed regional biocontainment laboratory at the University of Washington.
Yeah.
Correct. Uh-huh. Which it should really be called, you know, a biodefense lab, because that's what it is. Sticking on that vein, though, of bad economics, it seems to me that the federal government putting up 39% of the money and having 100% control over what happens in the lab for 20 years mm-hmm. doesn't seem like, again, the definition of partnership to me is like something close to 50-50, and that doesn't sound like a 50-50 to me.
No, it sounds like it leans heavily towards benefiting the private actors, people like, do you know name some of the companies, Carixa, probably?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The companies that are signing on so far that have done letters would Fred Hutch and mm-hmm. I can't remember all the others.
Yeah, Fred Hutch, which just took a new discovery and privatized it, and one of their workers discovered some new procedure, and they've just starting, you know, had a major, you know, multi-million-dollar startup funded from it. So obviously, private initiatives come out of Fred Hutch all the time. So having them in on the deal is not necessarily talking about something that's going to stay in the public domain.
All right. Well, moving along, let's talk about, there was a transportation bill that was passed.
Yes, the legislature reversed itself. It looked like it was dead in the water at one point on Sunday morning, and then by the end of the legislative session on Sunday evening, they had a transportation bill. It was very interesting. The media coverage on the transportation bill didn't focus on the projects that would be funded. It focused on the increase in the gas tax, 9.5 cents over the course of the length of the bill, and really, the Democrats who pushed this through have done a very poor job of selling the bill, of saying what the benefits of this package are going to be for the cost. And part of the reason for this is we're not done yet. This is only a partial funding of the transportation bill that is coming due for this region. We had three major projects that got partial funding by the gas tax increase. Those being the Alaskan Way Viaduct got $2 billion or so out of the $4 billion that the preferred option will cost.
$4 billion minimum,
right. Well, these are all minimums. These aren't including the cost overruns that will probably take place. 520 Bridge was only a half a billion out of the $2 to $3 billion that it'll cost, and one out of $3 billion for the 405, and nothing at all for the complete reconstruction of I-5 that's going to need to take place through the city of Seattle in the next 5 years or so, because I-5 is coming to the end of its useful life. From when it was built in the early 60s.
Yeah, I found it kind of interesting, you know, all of the articles that have led up to the we need more money for the 520 bridge, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, every time they talk about the 520 bridge has to be replaced, they ignore the fact that until very, very recently, all of the plans that looked at potentially expanding capacity for traffic across the lake involved building a second bridge next to the current 520 bridge and having lanes going in one direction across the old bridge and coming in the other direction across a new bridge. So, and then it also ignores the fact that if you try to pin down the Department of Transportation, the State Department of Transportation people, and ask them, really, is the 520 bridge at the end of its useful life, they kind of waffle. They say, well, it's been through all these major earthquakes, it's been through storms, et cetera, et cetera. And you say, well, isn't that a sign that it's well built? You know? I don't really see how it's absolutely necessary. I haven't seen the studies that say, you know, the 520 bridge has fallen apart. Like we've seen all of the engineers come out and say, well, you got to replace the viaduct. You have to because it's moved X amount, you know, or it's tilted by X degrees. Nobody has actually come out and said that about the 520 bridge. I mean, they've said, well, a ship hit a pontoon, you know, last year, and that damaged the pontoon and closed down some lanes for a while. I mean,
that's not the equivalent of a major
earthquake.
That's
not the equivalent of saying it's not going to withstand a major earthquake of X, you know, of X magnitude, like they're saying about the Alaskan Way Viaduct. So I would like to actually see some data on, is it necessary to replace the 520 bridge right now, like we know it is necessary to replace the viaduct now.
Yeah. The catch with the funding out of the state transportation plan is that the funding will get yanked back if there is no regional transportation plan to match it that gets approved by voters by January of 2007. So sometime in the next 22 months or 20 months or so, voters are probably November 2006 is what we're looking at for a ballot measure. Voters are going to have to approve a plan that has been gridlocked in the Regional Transportation Improvement District for the last 4 years. Originally, the RTID was formed in 2002, I guess it was, to put together a plan to put to voters. And these are comprised of county council members from the three major counties, Pierce, Snohomish, and King. And it has not gotten anywhere. And there was a plan that was moved out of the committee last year, but the corporate funders who were going to back the campaign said, no, we're not going to do the campaign because we don't think voters will approve it. So you still have to take to voters on top of the 9.5% or 9.5-cent rather gas tax increase. You still have to have this regional transportation plan. We're still going to have to kick in more money in order to get any of these plans funded because the money for these major projects is going to kick back to other projects if voters don't match it in the next 20 months.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, it's not a very good prospect.
No.
All right. Well, staying with that theme tangentially, the Bush came out with a energy plan this week.
Well, he's pushing the Congress to pass his energy plan. It's been on the table for some time now. And in his energy plan, there's a lot of incentives. In fact, I would say the bulk of his energy plan involves incentives to the nuclear power industry, including this risk management insurance, in which the federal government would provide payments to nuclear power companies whose projects are tied up by federal regulation. And I find that too. And when they proposed this, there was no study done of how much money this would cost the federal budget in order to provide this insurance to companies who want to build nuclear power plants. And this comes at a time when it's just, I believe, just a couple of days past the 19th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear accident in the Ukraine. And there's been a lot of information released lately on problems with the sarcophagus, or the concrete structure that entombs the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. There are cracks in the sarcophagus. It's leaking radiation. Attempts to repair the dome have been going very, very slowly because workers cannot stand to be in the general area of the Chernobyl site for very long at any one time. And analysts have said that if the dome of the sarcophagus collapses, as it may and may do very soon, it could lead to the release of radiation that is much worse than the original accident itself. So I think this is a cautionary tale when we're thinking about ramping up nuclear power again, particularly in this new environment where there will be less federal oversight of the nuclear power industry than there was 20, 30 years ago when there were major problems with it in the first place, that we should think about Chernobyl and what kind of a problem it can cause if there's a nuclear accident like that.
Yeah, and we're also seeing under the Bush administration a lot of underwriting for the export of nuclear power and the nuclear energy industry to other countries. And we're also seeing in the energy bill, particularly the House version of it, an enormous amount of underwriting to oil and energy companies in general. So so it's a pretty corrupt bill.
Well, it's interesting, too, that they would propose federal, did I catch you right, insurance?
Risk insurance.
Yeah. When the industry itself had, through the Price-Anderson Act, had limited the amount of insurance that they had, coverage that they had to have on nuclear facilities years back to, I can't remember, it was like $200 million or $500 million, where they're basically saying, you know, beyond that point, that's just, we can't afford to do that. So, I mean...
So we're just not going to.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but but it'd be fine if that bill gets picked up by the
American
taxpayers.
Yeah, this is a different kind of insurance. It's not an insurance that involves what happens in the case of an accident. It's insurance for if a nuclear power company decides they want to build a new type of plant, but that new design is going to take some time to make its way through federal agencies to be approved, then this insurance covers any loss in costs for waiting for delays and waiting for the new first power plant to be built, et cetera. I mean, it's an endless, bottomless pit of federal money being given to these energy companies for no product, essentially.
Right.
Or a really troublesome, dangerous product.
And at the same time, we're seeing reports coming out that the energy companies' profits are at record highs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's like, it isn't like they don't have money they could invest.
And one of the biggest concerns with this is that we're seeing it's been a generation since we've had nuclear energy in this country, or new nuclear energy in this country.
More than 20
and
years.
I think there's a public education that needs to take place where people need to understand what the risks are, because we talk about Chernobyl, we talk about Three Mile Island. Those are in the vague historical past for a lot of people in this country right now. They don't remember, they don't understand what the risks of nuclear power are.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
All right. Well, before we run out of time, let's jump to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yes, there was some data that was released this past week. The Bush administration has been keeping this data from the public. It's the number of terrorist attacks counted by the Bush administration in Iraq during 2004. It turns out that information had been taken out of the State Department's Patterns of Global Terrorism report by Condoleezza Rice. She had removed all the country-by-country data of the number of terrorist attacks that have occurred in various countries around the world before it was released. This was unprecedented. It hadn't been done in the 19 years that the report had been published. She just decided single-handedly to do it. However, the full report was given to Congress, and this past week, Representative Henry Waxman from California, he's a Democrat from California, he pretty much leaked some of the key data.
A very courageous Democrat. He's done a lot of very good things.
He has pretty much leaked the key data from that report by sending an open letter to the Bush administration saying, why aren't you providing these numbers to the public? They have a right to know. So what are some of the numbers that the White House wants to hide? 200 significant terrorist attacks in Iraq took place in 2004, more than occurred worldwide in 2003. There were a total of 650 significant terrorism attacks that occurred worldwide in 2004 versus only 175 in 2003. And in 2003, that's the year the Bush administration invaded Iraq, only 22 significant terrorism attacks had occurred in that country. So it went from 22 up to 200 in a year. Also, terrorist attacks in Afghanistan increased from 14 in 2003 up to 27 in 2004, in spite of the fact that the Bush administration has been pouring millions and millions of dollars into that country to try to suppress the Taliban, which unfortunately still does exist and still does carry out attacks in Afghanistan.
So what we can say here is that in the war on terror, terror is winning.
Yes, I think that's pretty clear. It's not funny, but it's pretty clear. What the U.S. government has finally admitted, however, even though they won't give us the terrorism statistics, is that the Iraqi insurgency is again on an upswing. Well, in fact, it hasn't really been on a downswing. This week, General Richard Myers of the Pentagon told Congress the numbers. He actually released some statistics on the numbers of insurgent attacks. These are attacks of all kinds that occur in Iraq every day. He said that they're currently at 400 attacks per week. Now that's about 57 separate attacks every day in Iraq. That includes bombings, shootings, rocket attacks, mortar barrages, car bombings, etc., you name it. Now, in fact, this supposed post-election lull never really took place. In late 2003, insurgent attacks were at 150 to 200 per week. That's about 25 per day. This is when the insurgency was really starting to ramp up. In April of 2004, after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, the attacks increased. They doubled to about 400 per week or more. Just before the elections in January, they doubled again. In January of this year, to about 825 in 1 week, and that's more than about 100 attacks per day. But then after the elections, they dropped back to about 350 to 400 per week, which we could guess is about, I don't want to say stable, but it really is about the usual level for insurgent attacks. So there never really was a lull. The insurgency is not ending. It is not coming to a halt, as the press here and the Bush administration would like you to think. In fact, an average of about 60 people are killed or injured every day in Iraq, and that includes U.S., Iraqis, foreigners, etc. And what I want to know is if General Richard Myers can tell Congress that about 60 people are killed or injured per day, including Iraqis, in Iraq, why can't the Pentagon release the number of dead Iraqi civilians? Since obviously they do keep count.
Which they are counting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I just want to say a quick word about the new partial interim government. Some cabinet ministers were approved this week by the Iraqi assembly. However, the cabinet ministers that were approved are predominantly Shiites. They are predominantly returning exiles. And unfortunately for Iraq, they have no new defense minister. The current prime minister, Ibrahim al-Jafari, he is the acting defense minister, and that post was supposed to be given to a Sunni politician. They have not been able to find a Sunni politician who will take that position or who is acceptable to the Shiites to take that position. This bodes very ill for the course of the country. And in addition, they did not name a new oil minister. Instead, they named one of their new vice presidents as an acting oil minister. That's Ahmed Shalabi, is now the acting head of their oil ministry, a man who was convicted of bank fraud in Jordan, will be the man in control of the Iraq's main source of revenue.
And who was an Iranian spy and defrauded the Bush administration. And yeah.
Wow.
That Ahmed Shalabi.
Yeah, that's pretty shocking. In addition, all of the major members of the new government are either Kurdish or they are returned exiles. There are no people who have stayed in the country during the time of Saddam Hussein's rule for any major length of time.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State, it comes out every couple of weeks. It has local, global news of interest, hopefully. You can find it wherever you find free publications, at bookstores, cafes, bookshops, etc. You can also find it on the web. You can find current as well as past issues on the web at www.eatthestate.org.